welcome to the Andrew Carrington Hitchcock Show. Today I've got a dear friend with me, Deanna Spingola, who I've been on her show several times. We've always had good shows. She's my mother's favourite host. My mother always says she's got very friendly manner and she always enjoys listening to the shows that I do with Deanna. So I'm going to say, Deanna, how are you today?
I'm very well. I hear a little echo, so not sure why.
I'm not picking that up. I think sometimes when the Skype starts for each of us, then that can... I'm not picking up at this end, so we'll carry on and see what happens. If there's a problem, we can stop. I was just going to ask you, what I tend to do on this show is that the first time I have a guest on, I literally hand the whole show over to them to explain their background, how they got into this movement, anything that they're involved in, books, radio shows. It's nice to have a gap from where you started. I mean, for example, you know where I am today with my research and the work that I've put out, but I started off listening to David Icke and Alex Jones, and I'm very far away from those people now. But it's interesting to know people's personal journey and anything else that you'd like to add to it. And then on any future shows that we do, when I open up the show, I'll say, if you want to know about Deanna, then listen to my first show with her, which is the bio show, and you'll know all that you need to there, and then we'll discuss any topics like you would do on a regular show, you know, back and forth between presenter and guest. So I'll hand over to you, and if you'd like to give us a bit of your story.
Well, thank you, and thank you for sharing the information about your mother's views of me. I always try to be friendly and genuine, and I really hate to talk about myself, but I did wake up years ago when my children were small. I read a book called None Dare Call It Conspiracy. None Dare Call It... Is that it?
Gary Allen book, yeah.
Yes, and I read that book, and I thought, oh my goodness, I have to do something. I can't, you know, let this go by. And of course, I was very upset over the Supreme Court decision about abortion.
Yeah.
And I thought this was all very terrible. It was just terrible, terrible. And I joined the John Birch Society because I thought, well, I have to meet with common-minded people. I have to get together and find out what's going on and be able to help to do something about it. And there was a local John Birch Society in the small California town where I lived. So I joined it. And in fact, I became the secretary treasurer. And it was run by a very big business owner there in that small town. It was about 30,000 people. And but it just didn't seem to go anywhere. And the other thing I noticed was that when I tried to approach my friends about some of the things that I was noticing, they would just, well, that they poo-pooed me. They just didn't have the same feelings that I had. We had the same kind of Christian values and things, and I didn't understand why they just figured that everything was fine. And that it was perfectly fine for people to be able to kill their unborn children. I just didn't get it. And I did lose some friends, which was kind of disconcerting for me. Nobody likes to lose friends. But then I got busy with my children after a time because it just wasn't going anywhere. I didn't believe that they really were keying in on, although they keyed in on some of the issues, I just felt they were very ineffective. And so I just, I got involved with other things, raising my kids, and then moving about, and my husband got another job in another area. And then, in the mid-90s, well, actually in about 1988, I found myself as a single parent. We got a divorce. My first husband and I got a divorce. And I had to earn a living, which I was able to do very well. And I also wrote a couple of books, which was associated with what I was doing for a living. I was in the textile industry, and I was an independent rep for several textile companies. And I kind of fell into this because I have an artistic side, and when I was married, I became involved in doll making, in porcelain reproduction doll making. I'm very detail-oriented. And so I bought this big kiln, and I had this business, and I was selling dolls. And in conjunction with that, I was making heirloom clothing, which is very beautiful, requires a lot of lace. And so I found some... I never wanted to buy anything retail, so I found some wholesalers. And one of the wholesalers I found, I ultimately went to work for as a rep, because I felt that I could do that. And in as much as I needed to work, and doll making certainly wasn't going to pay the bills, so I started repping. And the first company that I picked up, I repped as many as 7 different companies at one time. And I got paid by commission according to my sales. And I traveled in 5 different states, which was, well, it was a lot of work. And it was difficult. And I was on my own. And I not having a steady paycheck, I worked very, very hard. And I met a lot of interesting people. Now, the textile business is monopolized by Jews. They run the textile industry in New York. I repped a company that had relocated to California. And the first company that I repped was in Florida. And I began to notice a pattern that these various companies... Now, the first one that I started working for, as far as I know, never cheated me, never attempted to cheat me on my commissions. But I can't say the same thing for the other companies. In fact, one company that I repped, it didn't matter. I could sell $100,000 worth of laces and trims and things like that. And they had decided they weren't going to pay me any more than $500 a month. And I repped them for probably 2 months, and I said, forget that. You're dishonest, you're cheating. And and I also, in conjunction with the textile business, attended a lot of fabric shows, trade shows, all over. And the other pattern that I noticed was that the moral values, well, there were a lot of womanizers. And it was just interesting. And of course, when you're at a trade show, you know, there's commingling with a lot of people, and the vendors get together, and I don't drink, I don't smoke, so I wasn't prone to go out with any of these people or to socialize with any of them because, well, I just didn't. So I spent a lot of time in my motel room, and I took my sewing machine with me and started quilting. And led to my developing some unique patterns and things. And so I wrote 2 quilt books. And as I said, I'm very detail-oriented. And before that, let's go back a little bit further. I've always been interested, since I was a teenager, in family history. And so that was one of the things that I did a lot of. And I've taught a lot of family history classes. I was the director of a family history center that had between 40 and 50 volunteers. And so I was very, very heavily involved in research, so which was really very, very good to have kind of a research background, because you know that But when you're writing a book or whatever you're doing, it involves detail, it involves research, and of course doll making also requires a lot of detail orientation, because you're trying to, in doing reproductive doll work, you want to make these dolls look exactly like the very old porcelain dolls that the French and the Germans made. And so I practiced hours and hours and hours getting the eyebrows just perfect, getting eyelashes just perfect. And, and I also have a background in cake decorating, which is also very detail-oriented. So I'm just a very detail-oriented person, which is good, except it drives some people crazy because I like to include all the details because I find that everything is very significant. And so anyway, I was working living my life. And then I began to read a lot of things on the internet. And I had established my own website in 1998 for my quilts and my quilt books and my patterns. I also had a pattern company where I designed a whole bunch of patterns and sold those to different stores and stuff. So I had a lot of things going on. And then I began to subscribe to several websites because I still knew, you know, things were getting really, really bad. I remember when Ross Perot was running for president, and I supported him. I still have a Ross Perot button. I mean, I knew something terrible was going on. I was aware of NAFTA being passed and all these terrible things that were going on. And of course, then you have to think back about the JFK assassination, and obviously that was a government coup. And I saw all these things, so I started looking at doing research on the internet and subscribing to various sites where I could learn more. And of course, that would include Alex Jones. I listened to Alex Jones, and I thought he was kind of a buffoon. And he was a little over the top for me, a lot of showmanship there. Anyway, I began to write articles in 2005. And one of the first websites that I subscribed to accepted my articles. And I thought, wow, I'm going to be a journalist here. And so I began writing articles for this website. And then I picked up a couple more websites, or a couple more websites picked me up, I should say. And then in, 2009, as a result of my articles, a publisher contacted me to see if I would write a book. And I thought, oh my gosh, well, I'd never thought of doing a book, you know, a historical book or a book that related to the things that I was writing about. And then, lo and behold, 2 days later, in December of 2009, another publisher approached me. And I thought, holy cow, this is amazing. And I decided that I would go with the first publisher. It just seemed fair that I should select the one that asked me first. And so I began to write my book. And it got very, very, very big. It's like 1,200 pages. Because, like I said, I'm a detail-oriented person. I wanted to include all of this stuff. And anyway, I signed a contract with the first publisher that approached me. And he said he would give me some upfront money, which never occurred. And about 8 or 9 months later, after I had submitted the manuscript and just, you know, a month before it was supposed to come out, he called me up on a Saturday and he said, we've got to change things here. You can't talk about Jews. And I thought, I thought this was going to be an accurate historical review of things. And anyway, he wanted to give me an assistant, somebody that, by the way, had never written a book, and he wanted me to accept the assistance of this person, and she would kind of guide me. In other words, he wanted to assign a handler to me.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. And so I thought, well, and I was crushed. I was very, very crushed by his behavior. And I thought, well, you know, he's not honored the contract that we had signed. And so I thought, you know, I was discouraged. Oh, I was so discouraged. And I thought, heck, I can just do this myself. I'm just going to publish my own book. I don't need him. Mm. And by that time, I had remarried, and I was single for 6 years, but I had remarried, and my husband was very supportive, and so I just did my own thing. And because the book was so large, and this publisher wanted to stall the book for a year, and he said, yes, let's divide it up. And I thought, well, okay, that's a great idea, but I'm going to do this myself. I've always been very independent. Always very independent. I never went along with the crowd, ever. I mean, I made my own clothes from the time I was 12, and I did that, because I loved to sew, and I also didn't want to dress like anybody else. If somebody had the exact same outfit that I had on, in fact, one time, I went to it's like a Tupperware party, but it's for clothes. And I bought this outfit, and I thought, oh, this is really cute. And I wore it downtown the next day, and I saw somebody across the street that had the exact same outfit, and I returned it. I said, I don't do this. I just don't. This is not me. I'm not going to dress like that. I'm not going to have somebody else have the same outfit that I have. So I have always been incredibly independent. And that's just the way I'm made. So anyway, I did my book. It's called The Ruling Elite, A Study in Imperialism, Genocide, and Emancipation. And that was the first book in my trilogy. And the second book was The Ruling Elite, The Zionist Seizure of World Power. And the third book in the trilogy is The Ruling Elite, Death, Destruction, and Domination. And I do talk about the Jews, and I'm not sorry. No. Okay? It's accurate history, and that's what I wanted to portray, and that's what I did.
Well, as you say, it's a historical book, so at the end of the day, or rather a historical trilogy of books. And if you're going to talk about who really controls the world, and there's nothing about Jews in it, then it's not going to be true. So that also, a point I'll just raise is, Eustace Mullins' first book that, you know, my copy is called Secrets of the Federal Reserve, the one he did in 1952, mm-hmm. you know, and I think it was Mullins on the Federal Reserve. It's had different titles over the years, but the funny thing that happened to him afterwards was he was being attacked by groups saying that he was anti-Semitic. But I went through that book recently for a series that I'm doing, and there's going to be some episodes on Eustace, and I'd spoken to Eustace as well before he passed in 2010. I think back in 2006 we spoke a couple of times. And he said to me then, the funny thing was the word Jew is not mentioned anywhere in the book. But because all the organisations, these banking elites, etc., were Jewish companies, they said he was being anti-Semitic, but he never even pointed out that they were Jewish or Jewish-owned. And so they kind of shot themselves in the foot by dragging the anti-Semitic canard out when he hadn't even mentioned the word Jew.
Hmm. Well, I'm not, in my books, I do mention the word Jew, but it's not a hateful attack. I present the facts, and people can accept them or reject them. And, for instance, in my first book of the trilogy, I talk about Andrew Jackson, and he has been kind of this hero in the so-called truth movement. But the facts that I found did not support the worship that people have for him. And he is supposed to have said, oh, I'm going to rout the bankers out. And but he collaborated with the Rothschilds in London. The London Rothschilds became the correspondent bank for the United States. And his policies, his financial policies actually led to the one of the first crises, the financial crises in 1837. And so I just present the facts, and I did have a lot of flack from people in the so-called truth movement who said, this is wrong. But I present the facts, and I source my material, and there's plenty of footnotes. People can look at the same sources. And this is one thing that I learned in working with family history, is that you need to have your sources so that other people can look at the very same source and arrive at pretty much the same conclusions. And in fact, there's a code of ethics and conduct for people who work in family history. And I've tried to follow that code of conduct into the things that I do now. And part of that code of conduct is, and this is from the BCG certification, which is, if you're a certified family historian, then you are going to perhaps join the board of certification of genealogists, and which I never did. But I do believe that their code of conduct is very good. And let me just share that with you. And this is to protect the public. And number one, I will not publish or publicize as fact anything I know to be false, doubtful, or unproven, nor will I be a party directly or indirectly to such action by others. I will identify my sources for all information and cite only those I have personally used. And I believe that code of conduct is applicable to anything that a person is doing. That you don't publicize or publish anything that is false or doubtful.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And I think when I was looking into my work, and it's something I look back on at the time, because you've read my book and I didn't put footnotes in it, and it was just, it wasn't even meant to be a book. That was the whole point.
Right. It was just kind of, you were doing a timeline kind of a thing.
Yeah, and it was for my own use. And it was only that I sent it to Dale Bradford Smith and he put it up there, and then, you know, suddenly you see it on a site, and it was just, look, I like what you're doing, and I kept it, you know, for my own personal use.
Sure.
And then, but the criticism that I get is I don't include footnotes, but fortunately, because I did it in a timeline format, then people could generally put in, especially these days with the internet and what have you, they can put
Absolutely.
These facts in and do that. But certainly, the way you've done your book is the way I would have preferred to do it. But as I say, it just wasn't, it's just one of those things. I think it's sort of, when I did do it and I decided to do it as a book, I printed 500 copies and I never thought I'd sell them all. And it was only Dowell interviewed me, and, it was only when I sent a copy to kind of promote it to Tex Mars amongst other people that he published it, and the rest is kind of history. And now it's gone full circle. And I self-publish now, and
sure.
I like self-publishing because it gives you full control over your own work.
Sure, which is what you want.
Yeah.
And I believe wholeheartedly in timelines. I've done a timeline of book 2 and 3, and it's a work in progress. And in my timeline, I have not included any footnotes or links or anything like that, because it's a timeline, and it just gives people kind of a roadmap of when things happened, and in particular years where a lot of things that are very compatible or very significant happen all in one year.
Yeah.
So timelines, I totally understand not footnoting a timeline. I mean, it would take a monstrous amount of work. And like you say, the things that you have in your book, which is a fabulous book. And I referred to your book in a recent interview or a recent program that I did on the Noahide laws. Okay. And I referred to your book and where you give all of these places that the Jews have been banished from or expelled from. And, I mean, it's just fabulous the way that you put that together.
I think it's just the way that things link together. It was just...
Sure.
I mean, it's interesting here, because going back to when you read None Dare Call It Conspiracy, Gary Allen. Now, by my recollection, I think that came out in 1970, and I was wondering when you read it, if that was around that time or later.
I believe it was later. It was later.
But it was probably at that... it's one of those books that's actually sold millions. It's been a popular sold millions bestseller, and I don't think any other... You know, you can take some of the, you know, David Icke stuff or anything like that. They haven't sold like that. That was a conspiracy book that you could get in your local bookshop type of thing. And I guess that's why it had a circulation and what have you.
Yes. I don't remember exactly where I purchased it, but I, you know, I probably purchased it. Oh gosh, I don't know. But I just read it and reread it, and it just made sense to me, totally. Couldn't get any of my friends to read it, but I certainly did, and have tried to stay informed. You know, despite the personal things that were going on in my life, there was still, in the background, you know, I knew something was terribly wrong.
Yeah. And on that note, funnily enough, do you find that what I find in life is that I have my friends related to my book and my work, etc., and I have friends that I know in life that don't want anything to do with that, and that includes most family members as well. And so I have the people...
Relatives, even. I mean,
yeah.
Friends and relatives that well, you just need to know who you can talk to, and you don't want to ostracize your friends. And you certainly don't want them to ignore or ostracize you. I mean, it just isn't something that you want to do, of course. And you do the best you can and try and relate to them at their level. I mean, you don't want to. It's like trying to force a piece of chocolate cake down somebody's throat. I mean, you can present it on a nice platter with a napkin. Or you can shove it down their throat, and you certainly don't want to take the attitude of forcing people to hear your views when they're not ready. And it takes a certain amount of readiness to accept some of the things that we believe, or that some of the things that we see going on. People just some people just aren't ready to hear it. But. I don't think that anybody should ever dislike or abandon people simply because they have different views. I mean, some of my best friends have different views on particular things. That doesn't mean that they're an agent or that I'm an agent. It's just that the things that they have read, the things that they have experienced, aren't the same as what I've experienced or read. But that doesn't mean that we need to be enemies or anything like that. I try to respect the views of other people, and I mean that's what you have to do. Not that you're caving in or acquiescing to what they believe. You simply maintain a friendship on a level where you both have commonality.
Yeah, I absolutely agree, and I think I mean, as you say, you can't. I mean, friends that I've got, they're pleased with what I do, but a lot of them, they just don't want to be involved in it because they see it as too depressing, or they've got other things to worry about. And I think a lot of the feeling out there is, well, if this is going on, I can't do anything about it. And if I look into it, I'll get depressed, etc. And I just think, well, you know, I've done what I can do to wake them up. If they wanted to know anything more, they can always ask me, but I don't want to go and bombard them all the time with information that they know that I've got if it's not something that they want. So I just put that to one side. But then at the same time, the friends I talk about, I've got people on, I never wanted to go on Facebook or Twitter or anything like that. And in the end, someone said to me at a completely different event, I was on a social event somewhere, someone, this was 3 years ago probably, everything's social media, you've got to do social media, and they were actually right. And I found out that on Facebook I've got a lot of friends. I think there's nearly 1900 actual friends on there, not likes but actual friends. And my Facebook page has become, literally I'll post something and it's become a chat room all of its own. Something goes up and somebody says something about it, and then someone else will criticise it, someone will say no, this is right, and they'll literally have a discussion all the way through. And then I get people that, obviously times like that, you get an idea of how to weed people out, if you see what I mean, like the trolls, etc. But you can't get everybody. And I've had situations where I've been at work and I've got home and someone's been trying to troll the Facebook page, and there's been some of my friends on there that have literally, friends I've never met but who I've emailed and corresponded with about the truth, etc., who've been on there defending me and doing that when I couldn't, because I was at work and I didn't even know it was going on because I didn't have any access to my computer.
Sure.
So, and this is, and I go to your side of things. I mean, always sort of the end of the week, start of the week, because that's when your shows you're doing, I always check out the Spingola Speaks website. I can't remember the exact address, but I've got it in my favourites, and I always go in there to check out the interviews to download. And it's my understanding that one of your listeners set that up themselves.
Yes.
For the archives, the audio archives one, and that's what I'm talking about, that you can get people out there that you might never have met, but they end up doing more for you than people that you know.
Exactly. Yeah, I'm hearing an echo, but...
Oh, I'm sorry about that. I think that's... sometimes when the Skype comes in and goes out, I've certainly got no problem. I'm recording it here, and I've not heard any echo from you, and I'm not getting any reverberating back from me. So I'm sure we'll be okay. But yeah, and I think it's worth it. Sometimes obviously we like to engage the listeners, etc. But it's worth giving them thanks, because just, you don't have to be just the person writing the books or doing the shows. If no one was going to listen to them and no one was going to spread the information, then it'd be pointless you or I doing our work in the first place.
And it is very interesting. This person who's been a longtime listener did set up SpingolaSpeaks.net, and he records the programs and takes out the commercials, and that's SpingolaSpeaks.net. And then I also have, of course, my own website is Spingola.com, which I've had since 1998.
So that was the one you did your quilt work and the...
Yes, and then I just, changed it to change the whole course. I mean, it used to have my patterns up and my quilts, and it was all quilt-oriented. And then I totally changed it. I'm not in the pattern business anymore. It is totally devoted to political and other issues like that. So, yes, this gentleman set up SpingolaSpeaks.net. He has all these wonderful links. He is a dear, dear friend, and I just can't thank him enough for doing this. I mean, he just, it's fabulous. And he also created ScreeningSandyHook.net for my most recent book, and he set that up. And, I mean, he's just a dear, dear person. We've never met.
Yeah.
We've never met. And this literal stranger has embraced me and has done all these kind things for me, and because he believes in what I'm doing. And I think that, and we've never met. Never met.
Well, and from my point of view, he's done things for me as well, because by cutting out the adverts, and funnily enough, this is something that whenever the guy I got into mainly when I started off was Dale Bradford Smith. That was the person that got me away from the Alex Jones type of thing. And he was on RBN and he was on GCN.
Right.
And you get to realise when you listen to someone's show every day on one of these networks, the commercial breaks are in exactly the same place. So I've got a little program called MP3 Direct Cut, I think. And I could literally, as soon as I download that show, I'd open it up in there, I'd go forward to, I think it was 16 minutes, I can't remember, so long ago, but I think there were three different segments I'd cut out and I could just find them straight away, get the mouse to there, play it, hear, oh, this is the music coming in, hit the start button, wind to hit the end button, cut that bit out, and get it all done within a couple of minutes. And as a result, some couple of years later, he'd just broadcast, he'd never even bothered downloading his own archives. I think, certainly with GCN, I think even if you were a presenter on there, I don't know if it's the same then, I might even be wrong now, so I can't say for definite, but I was led to believe, and I'm not sure if this is from Darryl or not, but just because you present on there, unless you've got a GCN account that you're entitled to download the archives from, you're not going to get hold of the archives anyway. And so when he suddenly went from there, because all this work, if you added it up, or if it was someone who was unfamiliar with doing it, and suddenly they had to cut all these files, it would be a hell of a lot of work. But I put them all onto DVD discs and sent them over to him by mail, and so he could pull them onto his computer, and they subsequently, he got to know someone who helped him with his website, and they upload it, so he had, now he's got all his archives on the site. So this is the sort of thing, I've been in the position that your listener who set up SpingoSpeaks.net, you know, it's also in now, but it's such invaluable work. And to me, I think everything that you do, I had a situation recently where I was doing a bloodline show, and the guy who was recording it, it was going out live, but they hadn't recorded it. And so we were going to have to do the show again because it was part of a series that we were doing on the protocols. And anyway, one of our listeners recorded it. And then they set up I hadn't even think to ask people to say, look, did anyone record this? Because I thought people don't bother doing that anymore because they know it's going to go into the archive. But they recorded it. They set up a little place where I could go and retrieve it. And then we got it. So it saved our file. And so it's little things like this that, that people do that it's, you know, we're just part of a big community. And the more people that are awake is the only way that is going to change things. What you write and what I write, we're completely committed to the truth that we present. But just you and I standing alone isn't going to change anything. It's going to be the people out there that tell others and participate as well that gets the whole thing going.
Indeed. How true. And I've met people in other countries. Well, I haven't met them. I've communicated with people in other countries. And they share, well, like this morning, somebody in Greece sent me a video, and the video is titled, Putin Welcomes the European Jewish Congress. And it's just a little four-minute video. And I have also talked with an individual in Russia, and he's told me, he's shared with me a lot of things about the country that are misrepresented here in this country. And it was a result of him listening to the archives of my programs at SpingolaSpeaks.net. And he left a comment, and he kind of repudiated what was said by one of the other commenters. And so I emailed him, and during the time, I've been a little bit under the weather of the last 6 weeks, and so I haven't been in communication with him as much as I would like, but we exchanged several emails, and he has told me so many things about Russia and about Putin, and I mean, for instance, you know, people say, oh, they don't have any GMO foods over there, and the Jews aren't in control or anything like that. Well, you know what? They have Roundup in Russia, and they the Jews are in control, which made sense to me because, I mean, they took over control in 1917-18. You're not going to take over a country and then relinquish it later.
Exactly. That's what I always say. You're not going to take control and then give it back. It's like all this business about things like the Bank of England was nationalised, etc. When communists take power in Russia, they take everything for themselves, which just happens to be their Jewish controllers, because that was the people behind them. But when it's reversed round and it's like, oh, we've got to nationalise something, they don't take that, you know, be it the Bank of England or be it privately owned railways in this country that ended up being nationally owned railways. They don't just say, right, we're having that, you're not having it anymore. They have to physically buy it from the people. So in order to do that, it's worth so much that they have to give them bonds, etc., which technically still gives them control anyway. And so this is the difference between when a state nationalises something, they're not just taking it off the person, they're paying them top dollar for it. But when the communists come in, they just take the things that belong to people and whoever, and they just steal it.
Sure, sure. And actually, I've had a Skype conversation with this person, and some of the information that he shared with me is just very vital, and he's talked about Putin worship, and talked about the comments on the website, and anyway, it's been very interesting to talk to him, and about things. Let's see. Anyway, I'm just kind of going through his. The emails.
No, it's interesting. And while you're looking at that, because this is one of these things that you see out there about, you know, Putin's a good guy and all this sort of stuff. And I've always been concerned because I'd be really happy if he was. Do you know what I mean?
But my problem is. Oh, yes, but even if he was, what does that have to do with this country?
Yeah,
he's not going to come over here.
No, but one thing that I heard recently was, and I looked it up and it was completely true, that his daughter had married a Jewish guy. And then looked that up, and then this isn't just the Jewish guys involved in all this banking and stuff as well.
Of course.
So you're telling me that they're not linked?
Yes.
Exactly. And then you look, obviously, all the pictures of him with the Chabad Lubavitch and stuff like that, and then people out there saying, well, you know, he has to do that because he has to sort of stay in with people. I've never seen a picture of Adolf Hitler surrounded by Lubavitch rabbis.
I have not either.
So,
going to Israel and supporting the Red Army and saying, oh, what a wonderful thing that they did, and he supports the Holocaust. And I mean, it's just very interesting. And I'm not, I'm totally aware that they did not relinquish the country and that the Jews are fully in control and that things are going on in that country in the exact same way that they're going on in this country. And that's what I believe. I'm going to send you a link to this video. I mean, it isn't that Putin welcomes a few Jews. He welcomes the European Jewish Congress. So I'm going to Skype you this link so that you can look at this video. And this was from a friend in Greece. And so, you know, you can make friends with people in different countries and learn things from each other. And it's a wonderful thing.
Well, I can see them all gathered around him there anyway in the picture. But certainly, yeah, I mean, again, and just to sort of what we were talking about, spreading information. I mean, now that I've got this, I'll watch it and I'll post it to my Twitter and then it'll go out to my Facebook. And as I say, there's nearly 1,900 people on there. And then they'll share it and we just move things around like that. But certainly with your side of things, we've talked about the books and what have you. And we've got about... 13 minutes left, I think, 12, 13 minutes. And talk me through how you started off as a broadcaster. Were you broadcast? Did you start off doing interviews for someone else?
Well, yes, okay. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
I said it wrong. I meant, did you start off as a guest or did you start off with your own show? And basically, what places have you been on? What what networks have you been on or been on your own, etc. Just give us a rundown of your journey through that as well, because that would be interesting to know as well.
Alrighty. I started off as a guest on a couple of different programs on RBN. Okay. And namely, Rick Adams had me on several times. And then when I figured that I was kind of done with my book, I was thinking, gosh, RBN doesn't have many women on their broadcasts. They just don't, they're not well represented. So and this was when I thought I was done with my books, and I really wasn't. But anyway, so I called up John Stadtmiller, and I suggested that he needed to have me as a radio host. And so he gave me a shot, and he said, he gave me a Saturday night from 9 to 11. Now, I am not a night person. By 9 o'clock at night, I'm ready to shut things down because I get up very early.
Same with
and
me.
And so I'm just not very bright at 9 o'clock at night. And so the first Saturday, I tried to lay down and take a nap so that I wouldn't be tired. And that didn't work because I don't take naps. So anyway, I struggled through, I think it was 3 or 4 programs. And then he decided, well, maybe she's got something there. He decided to give me a program Monday through Friday for an hour. And so I did that. And I loved it. It was nice, and I had guests on. Interesting guests. People that I'd read their stories or saw them on the internet. I had a lot of interesting guests. And you can see the guests that I've had if you look on my website, spingola.com, and under radio schedule, you can go back to the beginning, to my very first programs in 2010 to see who I've had on. And, anyway, it's been an interesting journey. And then I got a 2-hour program and, Monday through Friday. In 2014, he brought in somebody else, and he switched me to Sunday, which I didn't really care for, but it was an opportunity, so I took it. It was Sunday afternoon. And then at the beginning of 2015, I moved to Saturday. So which is fine. And when I think back on it, I think, how in heaven's name was I able to complete the trilogy and do a daily Monday through Friday program?
I was just curious as to the time it went out, your time, Monday to Friday. What time of the day?
It was 11 to 1
when morning.
I was on the Monday through Friday. And
okay. So and, lunchtime and show, really.
Yeah. And then when I was beginning to talk about Sandy Hook at the beginning of 2014, and then I got switched, and which allowed me, in fact, somebody had approached me about writing a book about Sandy Hook, and I thought, okay, I've already done some preliminary investigation. I'd already done a critique on some films that I had watched. And so when my radio schedule changed, I thought, okay, yeah, I can do a book about Sandy Hook. And then the publisher that asked me, excuse me, changed their mind. So I thought, oh, okay, I'll just publish it myself. So that's what I did.
Well, I mean, now I would always publish myself, really.
Sure, yeah.
You just I mean, and these days you can go direct onto all sorts of mediums. It's not like self-publishing years ago where you could only go through one obscure website that people have never heard of unless you put it on your site. You can get on all the main channels these days. And
oh,
also,
absolutely.
It just gives you the control. When you do look at, just to give the audience a bit of a background, if you're going out to your Walmart or something and you see books in there, then the royalty that people are being paid on that is probably between 1% and 2%. And people think that's really low. But the way that they work it, you see, the way that publishers work, is they tend to say, right, the more exposure we give the book, the lower the royalty we'll give you. But technically, you should sell more books. And so you kind of decide which deal to take, if you like. Now, obviously, that's not going to happen on some Stephen King or Harry Potter, that type of thing, that is automatically going to make a lot. And these authors have a lot more power over the publisher, but a regular writer that's starting out. But generally, what a person would get, a reasonable sort of royalty, is about 5%, and that's really all that they get. But obviously, if you self-publish, not only can you can basically charge less, and you'll also get more of a royalty.
Right.
And this is something that is worth bearing in mind these days. With not just that, but anything in life. When you look at people setting up their own radio shows and all these different things, people literally making films out there on YouTube, all sorts of stuff that you can do yourself now, that, you know, years ago was tens and tens of thousands of pounds to do. And then you need all these experts involved to do it. But these days you can do it. And all these different facilities that we have out there, it's very important to utilise as many as you can, because we can compete with Hollywood. We can compete with the mainstream media with the tools that we've got available to us now.
Right. And, you know, I did use a company a self-publishing company, which I wouldn't do again. Because that you are regulated still a little bit too much. Like the image that I wanted to put on my book, they would not allow me to put it on the book because they said we could get sued or
really?
You could get
That's
sued.
Interesting.
So you do have to be really careful. But I would never publish again like that. My next book, there is a next book. I'm going to do it through Creative Space. I'm going to do it totally on my own. And I will check out, you know, the copyright issues and whatnot. But even when you self-publish and use a company, there's still some regulation involved.
Yeah.
And you know, the idea of Facebook. I joined Facebook several years ago, just to keep in touch with family. And I did not want to expose my family to any ridicule or jeopardize them in any way. So I've not been active in Facebook at all. No. But given your comments, I'm thinking that maybe I should put up a Spingola Speaks only Facebook where people, my listeners, the people who read my book, can communicate with each other.
I think it's useful. I mean, certainly it's proved popular, you know, from the people that follow me on there. But I kind of, because I've always been anti it anyway, I never had it set up. So when people, you know, where I was working and stuff,
yeah.
I was never going to be on Facebook with them because I don't have an account. So my account has always solely been for this purpose. And the same with my Twitter as well. But I think the only thing, you could try that. The only thing that it might, obviously each time you're logging in, you're going to have two different
exactly.
setups. And so, I mean, what I do, for example, is I've got a personal email that I deal with, you know, friends and my own personal matters through, you know, whether it's audio or something from, and then I have the Hotmail address, which is on the website, and that's what I deal with anything to do with the book through. And so I can, because they're different platforms, I can have them running, concurrently and, still be able to check out my personal email and my email relating to the book and things like that.
Sure.
So, but if I had two Hotmail accounts, I think it'd be very difficult to have two Hotmail accounts open on the same computer at the same time.
Sure.
But, yeah, no, it's interesting. And, what was I going to say? Well, certainly your story has been really, really great to hear today. And we've still got a couple of minutes. So if you, let us know what your plans are for the future and anything that you've got in the pipeline, and also your details of where people could listen to your current show, the broadcast times, etc.
Alrighty. My program at RBN is from 6 to 8 p.m. Chicago time on Thursday and Friday. Now that could go away as soon as Mr. Statmiller finds somebody that would like to take the slot that Clint Richardson vacated. And I also have my program, the regular RBN program, on Saturday from 3 to 6 p.m. And that, of course, is Central Time. And you can listen to the archives at RBN or at SpinGolaSpeaks.net without the commercial breaks. And you can also make comments. And we certainly do invite comments on the programs at SpinGolaSpeaks.net. And then there's another gentleman that also uploads the program. His name is Wooly. And he has a wonderful, well, he used to be associated with another website that uploaded programs. And he has a website. Let's see, what is it? Wooly's Blogspot. I don't have it right in front of me. But people can listen. I'll put a link on my website for Wooly's website. And he uploads the programs where you can also make comments. So, again, you depend on other people who embrace your same views to assist you. And without that community, where would we all be? If we were all in this alone, oh, that would be awful. But we're not. We have people all over the world, all over the country, who share our views. And that's the one thing that we do have.
Excellent. And that now starting the exit music. So it brings us towards the end of the show. But before we go, Deanna, just a shout out to the guy, and I'm embarrassed that his name escapes me, but he phoned into our last show together. He's the truck driver who hands out interviews, etc., to different people. You know who I mean?
Oh, Gary?
Yeah, that's it.
Yes. You lovely see? Man.
Yeah. These are the people we're talking about, folks, the people out there who really spread this message. So thank you, Deanna, for being my guest today. Thank you, everybody, for listening, and we'll see you soon.